Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And today I am joined by Amber Shereza. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me. So would you like to just introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit about your background, really, because you are a survivor yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. So basically, I've grown up undiagnosed neurodivergent. It was a particularly toxic family system. I was always the scapegoat. I was, pushed out, pulled back, blamed for this. You know, everything was always my fault. I was locked up, assaulted. You know, it was a really quite difficult upbringing. When it was time for me, when I started changing hormonally, that was quite a big thing for me, and it led to me speaking out. I started speaking up a little bit more after that. Basically I was misdiagnosed, medically labeled, chemically lobotomized, treated as though I was the problem. Abusers, I think they rely on these tactics of pathologizing out trauma responses, so that it can justify their actions, in the terms of systems, the NHS, school systems, education, everything. They really do rely on destroying your credibility. Misdiagnosis is a huge part of my life. It's followed me throughout. From that, I think I was conditioned to accept abuse. So relationships weren't great from that. I fell into a people pleasing role. I was happy to accept the blame. And I suppose for a long time, the shame that I carried, I would blame myself, because I genuinely believed that diagnosis, that I was bad, I was wrong. Just my existence was an issue, to people. And now, after seeing the patterns and sort of fighting my way out of it, I'm just here now just to raise awareness, just so that other people can maybe spot that in themselves, so that they can see what's going on, and try and maybe, see themselves with more love and care, so that they can stop relying on the people that are maybe treating them badly.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously had a chat the other day on the phone, and we spoke about this in depth, didn't we? About the pathologization of trauma responses. It's designed to position you as unstable, unreliable, volatile, position you as the problem. And detract away from their own behaviours.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you name a girl broken in public, then you don't have to fix what you broke in private at the end
Exactly.
of the day.
Exactly.
That's just the fact of it, and that's what they rely on.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is exactly why I am a firm believer in, trying to keep labels off the table as much as we possibly can, because they muddy the waters. They don't do victims any favours whatsoever. From a personal perspective, it does position them as volatile and unreliable. And I've had cases that I've supported myself where the professionals have admitted that that's how they've been viewed because of these labels. They've completely bypassed the trauma aspect of it and what they've been subjected to. They've just been purely focused on the fact that, oh, there's that label. they must be volatile and unreliable. So let's just switch off.
It's the confirmation bias of it that's damaging, I think. They see something written down, and then, everything that they see, if it fits, that's what sticks. It's confirmation bias. They don't try and look outside of what is already written down in front of them. And that's unfortunate for a lot of victims.
And unfortunately, it doesn't work in the same way with perpetrator behavior. If they are labeled, that is viewed as, oh, well, we can't say that their intention was to cause you that harm, and their intention was to make you feel like that. So it's used in very different ways depending on what your role is in that relationship.
Yeah, one thing I've found is if I've ever used the phrase, my ex was narcissistic or acted like a narcissist, I have been torn down for that. And we're talking about a person who had literally left me unconscious after choking me. And if he can do this to me, and I can't call him narcissistic. It's very dependent on which role you play. I think you're right there.
But even with the professionals, though, this is how it's viewed, unfortunately, and this is why I am a broken record with things like this. Is it really doesn't matter, whether people agree with me in terms of how much weight and credibility there is in the diagnostic process and the DSM and the labels as themselves. If you name and label your perpetrator with a as mentally disordered, with any psych any late any disorder that's listed in the DSM, you are handing them a get out of jail card on a silver platter.
Yeah,
Um,
I did find
the
that.
the professionals don't, certainly the police and CPS, they don't need a reason to use mental health. They use that excuse far too easily. So if you give it a name, well, you're adding weight to an excuse that is too easily come by. So I always say to people, please, and always get out the habit of calling them a narcissist as well, because over and over and good, you say it, people saying, but I won't say it in the courtroom, and I won't say but if you're angry and you're triggered and
It just slipped
they
up.
say something that like just really, really gets you, really annoys you and irritates you or triggers you in any way, shape, or form, you can say it without even realizing it, and once it's said, that's it. You can't take it back.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that, to be fair. And they do seem to have a real way of being able to trigger you, don't they?
And even the same, that's just a perpetrator. That's the professionals as well. So always get out the habit of just saying it at all. There's no point. We have perfectly acceptable language to use within the legal arena, which is the coercive control, stalking. We have language to use. But no, it is it's too common for perpetrators to make their victims feel like they are the one that's going crazy. I know that's how you very much you were made to feel, wasn't it?
So my ex-partner was arrested maybe 3 times. And twice I was told to do, he rang me as soon as he was let out, even though he was told not to. He said, we need to come, we need to talk. Naturally, I said yes, because, he was going to turn up anyway. I better keep it light. And then I was convinced that, I was overreacting, and I should drop the charges, because, he's been sat in there, he was treated like a dog, and it was so bad for him. So twice I did that. And then the third time, he was concerned that they were going to look at this suspiciously. So he told me the best thing to do would be to call the police and set up a meeting, and then to sit this police officer down and to explain to him that I am suffering really badly with bipolar disorder and stress, and I made it all up. He did not do any of the things that I said that he did. I told them, I said he's suffering with a lot of stress, having to care for me. I was actually really quite disgusting about myself, thinking back now. That I swallowed all of that as well. It's one of the most insidious parts about it all is that, I believed all of that. I did genuinely believe all of that.
And that is a common thing that happens. And I say I've seen one particular case that I stepped in on was a replica of that, and that was when I was asked to step in because CPS wanted clarity on why this victim had withdrawn two statements, and one of them was exactly what you've just described. It's not uncommon.
No, it happens all the time. I can believe that.
It does. And this is what professionals need to really understand, that they need to learn to read tone. They need to, because I can guarantee you there would have been an element of dis-ease with you when you were saying all of this.
100%. I would be chewing up my, That was how I always presented, like this, eyes at the floor, biting on my fingernails. You can see it if you're looking.
And that's what it means to be trauma-informed. Trauma-informed is not just acknowledging people being in distress. It's not just showing somebody who is in distress empathy. Being trauma-informed is being able to read micro cues like that, and read the energy in the room. It is literally about getting curious. You have to get curious, because a lot of the time, as you just said, you believed it. You believed it.
I did 100% wholeheartedly. I was the problem, and if I could just try harder and I could just do better, he would not be like that towards me. Because I deserved bin bags being emptied over my head. I deserved all of that, because if I was just better, he wouldn't be like that.
And it's the same. It's the same when people are asked. You can see visibly, and they would have been able to see visibly fear within you. And but if they were to ask you in that moment, "Are you scared?" You likely would have said no. And even if you did say yes, and they asked you why, you might not be, you probably wouldn't been able to tell them why you were scared, to articulate it and put it into words.
I suppose it's hard because when you're in these relationships, well, when that was true for me anyway, I kind of viewed the person as two different people. I'd be like, no, because when he's great, he's great. And when he's not, he's not. And I split him completely apart. So when he would turn his attitude back around after I'd, after I'd called the police, or the police had been called by the neighbors, or after we turned it around, I then saw him as that separate person, that good person. So they're good at getting you to view them in two completely different lights as well. They rely on a lot of underhanded tactics, and it's very easy to say, why didn't you just leave? But it's all mental when it's all in the head.
I mean, I have described, I've tried to explain, I've explained this so many times to people. Both within my marriage, and growing up as a child within my home, my family environment. I grew up in a war zone as well, and it's very, very surreal. It's only when you look back and you realize what you were doing, because it's like you said, there's like two personalities, there's like two versions of them. So when the good comes back around, the brain doesn't want to focus on the bad. It's like a switch that flicks, goes off. It's like it like no, we've got to cling on to this positivity, this nice part of them, the things are calm, let's cling on to that for dear life. And it's like all memory erases temporarily until you do full cycle again and you come back round in a full circle to the devaluing, the gaslighting,
And then you see it.
and you then you
Yeah.
like, ah, yeah, no, I remember. And
Yeah,
then
100%. That's exactly what
until you
happens.
don't remember again. Until
Yeah.
it's not that you don't remember, it's like, no, I don't want to focus on that is too painful to focus on that. I need to cling on to this and hope with everything that I've got that it won't happen again, that they are genuine, that they do mean it when they say they're sorry. I mean, I know growing up it was, I very, very much saw my abusive parent as the apple of my eye. I idolized them, absolutely idolized them. Until I was afraid of them again. It
Yeah.
was like one extreme. It's like one extreme to another. Like an extreme high and then an extreme low. There was never anything in between. It was always one extreme or another. And I suppose, I know we I know not to pathologize this, but that's how they describe bipolar. But that is what that is, it's highs and it's lows.
Yeah, and that mirrors my upbringing exactly. Is I'm not going to sit here and pretend that it was all absolutely horrible, but it was, it was those absolute, insane, times that just completely overshadow, the days out that we had, My daughter hit the nail on the head. She said, even if my nan and granddad did come back now, I wouldn't be able to forget the last time I saw them because they'd walk past us like we didn't exist. And it was when I saw that it was damaging my children, it was potentially going to carry on for another generation, that I just said, absolutely not. No, I'm not going to let your patterns carry on and harm my children and let my children think that there's something wrong with them. Like you convinced me.
I've done the exact same thing with mine as well.
It is very hard going no contact. And you do
It
have to
is.
process a lot of guilt with that. I think they think that it's very easy for us,
No.
but it's not at all. I've had to process a lot of guilt, especially with regards to my dad.
Going no contact from a perpetrator that you're in a romantic relationship with is hard. But it's another level of hard when it is somebody who has brought you into the world. That is another layer of hard. And actually, it takes a lot longer to break away from those people than it does the person you're in a relationship with. I mean, it took me 43 years it took me. 43 years.
See, this is the problem, is it goes on and on. It just does. But then when you do find the courage, it was when I realized that, because I told my dad what I'd had to do when he put me out on the streets when I was 14 years old. I'll leave you to fill in the details there. But he said he came back to me and he said he sleeps fine at night and he has no regrets. And this was 3 years ago, on Christmas Day. And that was the last time I spoke to them. I thought, I'm not going to sit here and act the same way that I did when I was 14 and 15. I'm not going to break my hand trying to get back into your house. I'm not going to act like that. I'm just going to turn with my, with my push. I'm just going to go. And it was that moment there that I believe I chose myself, that I was able to start my healing journey. And now I end up here trying to help others as well and raise awareness.
Because that's not love. It's not.
It's enjoyment.
Yeah, it is. It is. And you know, if we hadn't have made that decision, what are we teaching our children? We're teaching them that behavior is okay, and then the cycle continues over and over again. It is a difficult, I mean, it is difficult. I mean, I don't know about you, but there is times where I sit and I think that, because obviously they are getting older, of course they're getting older, and you know, I sit and I think, how would I feel when they pass away? And I don't know the answer to that question. I genuinely don't know the answer to that question. I'll have to cross that big bridge when I come to it.
So
But
I'll share something with you. I couldn't process the guilt there, and I realized this last October. I put my baby in the pushchair, and I took the bus. I went to their house. I knocked on the door, and me and my baby got the door slammed in our face.
wow.
After 3 years, they hadn't met my child. They hadn't, They hadn't visited me in the hospital when I was sick, for those whole 9 months. I nearly died throughout the pregnancy a couple of times, due to allergic reactions and things. Nothing, not so much as a card. And then to have the door slammed on the face of my baby, I wrote a book. I wrote a book. I chose myself. And I decided I'm going to tell the world my story because it's one that needs to be heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what you, everything you've just described there is ironically how I ended up cutting that parent off. And I won't say publicly which one it is, but really for the sake of my brothers. I don't know whether they want me to or not. But yeah, that's exactly what I sim exactly similar. I was going into hospital. They had promised to look after my daughter, and they let me down. They didn't just let me down, they let her down. They
Yeah,
didn't ring to
physical
see
thing.
how I was, nothing. They have a medical clinical background themselves, so when I was rushed back in with complications, I messaged them and I said, I know you're probably not too bothered, but I will let you know anyway, out of courtesy, I'm being rushed back in with X, Y, and Z symptoms. They would have known that what that would have meant. They would have known that I would potentially have to have been rushed back into theatre. Nothing. Nothing.
No. And then the thing is, they'll be the first to say, it's been so hard for us.
Oh, yeah. And from that day, I have not heard it. My daughter hasn't had a birthday card, Christmas card, never, nothing, nothing, nothing. Where's
That's
my
so
other,
good.
whether, where's my one of my brothers, who's got a child? Their child's been getting obviously things, and but it's the fact that they've made an example out of my daughter to punish me. And that's the lengths that perpetrators will go to. They have no love for their children at all. They are detached from any emotion. Unless you are have a you you have, serve a purpose to them, you are useful to them, you are obsolete. The day you become not of use, you're obsolete. And that's the sad reality.
The sad reality is, I know exactly what you're talking about. My ex-partner, when I made it clear that there would be no more relationship between me and him, he left the baby in the car seat with his blanket, his dummy in, stuck his middle finger up at me and the baby, and very much said, nephew, you're on your own.
That's perpetrators to a T, unfortunately.
Absolutely, just I was gobsmacked. Now, I'm not one who keeps my mouth closed. I will say what needs to be said. But I was speechless, that he could just demonstrate such blatant disregard for his child, was just absolutely abhorrent, to be honest with you.
It is. Well, we're just going to break for a short interval and we'll see you after the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. I mean, you know, you mentioned about you had to be resuscitated, didn't you?
Yes.
For an attempt to your own life.
Yeah, I did. So in 2003, my ex-partner had decided that he was going to start contacting my current partner. Due to my upbringing, I was conditioned to accept abusive relationships, so I'd gone from one into the next. And basically they worked together to form a pylon situation. So from both angles, I had my ex-partner saying to my current boyfriend, oh, she says this about you, she's this, she's that, she's cheating on you. And then he was saying back to my child's father, my ex, that, you know, she never looks after the kids, she's always in bed, she's lazy, she doesn't do anything. And, you know, it was a very public humiliation ritual that I was forced to endure. I think maybe 2 weeks of this continuous, you know, phone calls in all hours of the night, threats to my house, to me, physical threats, people that I didn't even know jumping on the bandwagon. It wasn't too much. It was absolutely too much. I convinced myself that my children were better off without me. I convinced myself that, you know, it was harmful for them to see what they were seeing. I was never going to be able to show them how to be a strong woman. I was never going to be what they needed. So it was better that I just disappeared. And then, yeah, I came back around. I think the neighbour had heard me fall down the stairs, because I'd taken an overdose and then thrown myself down the stairs. And I guess he'd heard that because the window was smashed. And yeah, when I came around, I was in intensive care. I'd been ventilated, sedated. And yeah, I woke up completely alone. And that was the start of my healing process. Very slow, long road was where I started.
And you used a particular word, ritual, and that is quite fitting, isn't it? It was very much like a witch hunt.
It was. I felt hunted and hounded completely from everywhere. I couldn't walk down the street. I couldn't go to the pub. I couldn't go to the park with my kids. It was, coming from a small town, it was very, very hard for me to actually function at all. Yes, very public, very witch hunt.
The suicide rates are and obviously I spoke to Amber before, in the break, because obviously she mentioned it in the break about this, and it is in a book where she talks about this. Suicide rates are incredibly high, based off Tim Woodhouse's figures, in his Churchill report. We're looking at around about 900 victims a year take their own life as a result of domestic abuse, and that's just what we know of. I would argue that these are probably higher.
I think that's just shocking, and it,
It is.
but to be honest, I can see because you feel so alone and so much like the whole world is against you during that time.
Was there times where you had fleeting thoughts prior to this?
Definitely. Yeah, and I did speak up about them as well. I told mental health workers. I told police. I told people about how I felt. They would just tick a box to say that they'd given me advice, and then off they went.
And this is what professionals need to understand is, and I've said this before on other, in fact, I think I said it on my interview with Tim actually. I would hazard a guess that most victims may not have thoughts specifically thinking in the lines of, how you did, but have thoughts of, and actually in this, there's a recent case at the moment that's in court at the moment, in court, the trial's going on now, where this lady took her own life and there was police involvement. She was reported to the doctors. There was about over 100 logs on her medical records of abuse, reports of abuse, reports of inescapability, thoughts of inescapability. And one of the things that she said was, "Life, it's like life isn't worth living anymore." Now that may seem like very like a sweeping statement.
Yeah, quite broad and massive, maybe, yeah.
But this, you have to take comments like that very seriously. That is an unconscious thought of, I don't see any way out of this. I am trapped in this nightmare that I am living. That is what those words are saying.
It's about looking what the words are saying underneath, isn't it? And that's what these professionals need to be more, aware of.
And it's not very often that victims will vocalize things like that. So when they do show up, you have to listen. I trained with I did a quite a lot of training with Laura Richards, and she has a phrase that she says, and it was, in fact, it's always stuck with me. It stuck with me from the very first training I did with her. That she always used to say to, because she used to work in the Met, and she used to do trainings with them in the Met as well. And she used to say to them, "You have one mouth and two ears for a reason. Listen,
Twice as much as you speak.
listen, listen to what's been said to you, and that's the key. You have to listen." It isn't always going to be loud. It's more often subtle. So that's why you have
Sometimes
to
just a
listen.
look at the look, just watching the door, or just a flinch when a car door slams, or sometimes it's only slight, but it is there if you know what to look for.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that these thoughts of inescapability can come in so many forms. And again, they may not ever verbalize them. I mean, I know for me, I mean, I dodged bullets for abuse when I was going through cancer, and a perforated bowel. So I'm on both of those things. I dodged burst per, dodged bullets of abuse. And at its worst, I would catch myself thinking, and it would be a fleeting thought, and I'd instantly feel guilty for thinking it. If the cancer came back, that would be my way out. And I'd instantly, like, oh, my daughter, my daughter, my daughter. And I'd instantly feel terrible, sick to my stomach, that I'd even had that thought. And then I'd think, and now am I manifesting this illness? And I would feel bad because I'd had that fleeting thought of inescapability. They can look like that. So they come in so many different forms: thoughts of inescapability, thoughts of finality, thoughts of, I want a way out of this nightmare I'm trapped in.
Definitely.
And this is why I say that I would argue that most victims, and it may just be a fleeting thought, but the problem is, where the problem with fleeting thoughts is, it takes a moment to act on it.
Of impulsive,
And once somebody's, and in fact, there was a young girl, I cannot remember her name, but there was a young girl. I think she was 15. You might know of the case as I describe it. She reported rape to the police. She was dismissed, and because she'd exposed the perpetrating party, she was terrorized in school, to the point where she ended up taking her own life. But it was a fleeting thought, a momentary thought that she acted on, and then unfortunately immediately regretted it. But unfortunately, it was too late. The damage had been done, and it was I irreversible. And that's the problem. And this is why, as professionals, every single professional needs to listen, listen
Definitely.
for micro cues and watch. Because I'm going to go as far as to say, you don't just have two ears, you've got two eyes as well. Watch for the micro
Definitely.
cues.
Definitely.
Watch
We
and
all need to
listen.
do our bit, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the signs are there if you know what you're looking for, if you're curious enough to know, to look deeper and ask the right questions. And it's not something that you can teach,
No,
unfortunately.
this is it. People just have to have that natural curiosity to want to
Exactly.
dig deeper,
Yeah, you've got to think on your feet in the moment, and you've got to have the, you have to ha be trauma informed to a good enough depth to be able to think on your feet and ask the right questions in the moment, because it literally depends on the circumstances, on the environment that you're currently in and you're dealing with. But you have to learn to spot the signs quickly, because that can be the difference between saving a life and making somebody feel heard and validated. That can be the difference between them acting on something and not acting on something.
Well, it could be the difference between life and death, really, couldn't it? Let's just say
Absolutely. Yeah.
it like it is.
Yeah.
That's what we're dealing with at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're just going to break for another interval and we shall see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So Amber obviously has, as we've obviously established through the through this episode, she has broken the cycle, this very long generational cycle. And Amber obviously, as she meant, obviously dropped in there. She has written a book, but Amber also wants to, you know, similar to what I've done, really. She wants to turn. And how many people in this these situations, she wants to turn her pain into purpose, you know, which is what, you know, and everybody's journey doesn't always look like ours, you know, it doesn't, but it's about finding meaning in what you've gone through, so that you don't then sit and think, but why me? It's about finding meaning to what you've gone through and use and make and turning it into your superpower, I suppose. So do you want to just share what your hopes and future plans are moving forward before we?
Yeah, definitely. So like I say, it's not been an easy road to get here, but my healing journey has been it's been powerful. I suppose choosing yourself is the most important thing. When you choose yourself, you start to accept a level of respect, and you won't accept anything less. And that's the most important part. That when you start putting down your boundaries, when you start making decisions from self-trust, you know, not exposing all the parts that you try to hide, maybe, and pulling them out and asking, rather than letting them eat you up. So things that make you angry or needs that you perhaps had that you try to bury to be more likable, you know, pulling those up, getting to the bottom of them and asking, what's this trying to teach me, rather than just getting angry and spiraling. It's about taking that pain and transmuting it into something good, something positive. And really, that's what I'm trying to do now, is putting a name on, you know, all of the tactics, all of the all of the toxicity, calling it what it is, because if I can get the word out there, you know, maybe people can see it that they haven't seen before and know that that is actually what it is. You know, just raising awareness, opening the doors that abusers love to hide behind. One saying I can't stand is behind closed doors, we never know what goes on. Well, open them then.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, open
exactly,
them.
Yeah.
Put them
That's
down.
exactly it. Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, so many people don't like to get involved. You know, they may hear what's going on behind closed doors, but they don't want to get involved.
Yeah, I think I'm not choosing sides. I that doesn't wash with me. I think if you're saying I'm not choosing a side, that is a side. You've just picked the quiet one.
Absolutely. Path of least resistance I've chosen.
Yeah, it was easier for me to cross my arms and call it manipulation, or, you know, than to say what was going on, or, you know, yeah, they don't like to get involved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what's the name of your book?
So my book is called The Scapegoat Story, Sedation is Not Care. It's currently being published at the moment, but it will be out in July 2026. So yeah, it's
Fabulous.
really exciting.
Fabulous. Wonderful. And
Thank
where
you.
is that going? Where's it? Is it being published on? It would be on Amazon. And
yeah, that'll be on Amazon. Yeah. So yeah, that's really
fabulous.
exciting.
Super. Well, definitely keep your eyes open for that. It is always, certainly if you are going through it yourself and you are thinking, you've got question marks as to what you're experiencing, you're doubting your gut
Never
instinct.
doubt your gut.
Yeah. Oh,
Always
never,
trust your
never
gut
doubt.
instinct.
But
Yeah.
stories, and this is why, you know, every episode I do with survivors, with people who have gone through this, my hope is that one story that you hear that resonates with you deeply, and you think, that's me.
If my story
Maybe
can
I'm
touch this
not,
one person,
yeah, maybe I'm
then
not
it's
imagining
job
it.
well done. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. But yeah, have a read of a book, because I say, you know, obviously we haven't gone into loads and loads of depth in here, but the book will go into more detail, won't it? Right, well, thank you for joining me, and see you on the next episode.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.